So our first talk of the day is by Janet, who'll be talking about world military versus the global environment. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Morning, everybody.
Morning, Janet.
It's great to see old friends and also especially good to see lots of new faces. Welcome, everybody. All right, this is going to be a bit sort of serious, really, a bit sort of... it's not to put smiles on your faces. I'll just let you know that before I start, OK? But we'll see how it goes. See, that's the interesting thing. So, and I'm reading it because there's so much of it. I looked at so much stuff to put this together. There's no way I could remember so many facts and figures and, you know, numbers and whatever. So, excuse me, my head's going to be down a lot of the time as well. So, right. What are the reasons, the motives for starting, continuing and prolonging war? I would say endeavouring to follow what often seems like frequent changes of direction or rationale of the big powers can end in confusion for any observer. It appears to be war for war's sake. Hit the opposition hard when they're gaining. Step back when they're struggling, but keep the war going at all costs. It's good for profits, regional hegemony, whatever. Anyway, whatever the motives of the war makers are, will take second place today, because what we're now here for today is to take a look at the negative effects, and there are many, of the global military on our shared environment. One of the fundamental sources of pollution from the military, and often not taken into consideration, is the whole process from resource acquisition through to the finished products, be they vehicles, planes, ships, armaments. The total fuel used and emissions involved in mining, transport and manufacturing, plus the degradation from mining and disposal of waste in the process. And a number of sources, with plenty of evidence, agree that the greatest single assault on the global environment comes from the US military. So I'm going to take a look at some numbers in just a minute, but bear in mind while I'm talking numbers, that throughout the long history of military preparations, actions, incursions and wars, the US military has not been held responsible for the negative effects of its activities upon the environments, peoples or any other life. For instance, during the Kyoto Accord negotiations, that was December 97, the US demanded as a provision of signing that any and all of its military operations worldwide, including operations in participation with the United Nations and NATO, be exempted from measurements or reductions. Even after attaining this concession, the Bush administration then refused to sign the accords anyway, and US Congress passed an explicit provision guaranteeing the US military exemption from any energy reduction or measurement. As it stands, the US Department of Defense is the largest polluter in the world, producing more hazardous waste than the five largest US chemical companies combined. Depleted uranium, petrol, oil, pesticides, lead, and defoliant agents such as Agent Orange, along with vast amounts of radiation from weaponry produced, tested, and used, are just some of the pollutants with which the US military is contaminating our shared environment. As reported in Project Censored, US has more than 1,000 bases or facilities. Facilities are usually smaller than bases with masses of troops on them, but nevertheless they are active units. And these are more than 1,000 worldwide and more than 6,000 facilities in the US alone. To quote, the Pentagon is the largest institutional user of petroleum products and energy in general, yet they have a blanket exemption in all international climate agreements. And from Barry Sanders in his book, The Green Zone, the greatest single assault on the environment and all of us around the globe comes from one agency, the Armed Forces of the US, apparently accounting for a full 80% of the federal government's energy demand. What about expenditure? Well, while not wanting to single out the US as the only military polluting the planet, it does happen to be a focal point for comparing relative damage. For instance, you can measure military spending two ways. You can measure it in real terms, real money spent, and the second as a percentage of GDP. And military expenditure in real terms, it is important because since the absolute level of expenditure matters for the outcome of the war, but the US spending 10% of its GDP fighting a war is likely to defeat a low or middle-income country spending 50% or more of its GDP. Yet military expenditure as a percentage GDP allows us to get a handle on the priorities and the ambitions of a country. It's largely dependent on whether a country is at war or not. Outside of wartime, countries do continue to spend substantial sums on maintaining their military capabilities, although less than during active war. Right, here are some numbers to actually back up that little bit of what I've just said there. Being dominated by the United States, for instance, in 2014, after the United States, the next biggest four were China, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the UK. By 2016, it just changed slightly, and Russia overtook Saudi Arabia. India and France both overtook the UK. Now, listen to this. Total figures, percentage-wise. US, 36% of total. China, 13. Russia, 4.1. Saudi Arabia, 3.8. India and France, both 3.3. And the UK, 2.9. That is the six next highest spenders together were still less than the US. Compare 36% US, 30.4% for those next six. And as of June this year, Trump demanded a 10% increase in their spending to $54 billion. So now they spend more than the next eight countries combined. Just give some perspective on, because I'm mostly focusing on the US for this reason, okay? So the level of expenditure has a definite bearing on the damage done to the environment. So as I talk about these negatives, I said here, the US will again be the central focus. So I want to continue by looking at some of the many areas of damage that have been done to different areas in the world over many years, whether from testing, training, expanding bases, or outright warfare. Areas for consideration include ground, water, sea, air, and space pollution, from transport, missiles, bombs, depleted uranium, chemical contaminants, and dumps left behind. And just by the way, I have got a list of sources that I'll be quoting from. If anybody's interested, I've made a few copies. Okay, they're here. So a few examples. I'm going to start with, I think, which is the one is the most absurd that I've found. Between 1950 and 68, the US lost eight nuclear devices from a submarine, from aeroplanes, from ships. But where and how, you ask? Well, in the Mediterranean, in the Pacific, another incident, Pacific again, off Japan, and one in swampy farmland in North Carolina. None of them have been retrieved, and consequently there's no record of specific subsequent damage to the environment, okay? Here's a smaller one, but it's some kind of comparison. In April this year, the Israeli Defense Force planes sprayed herbicides inside the Gaza Strip for the second day running on that occasion, and that was the fourth time this year. No doubt it's happened since then. This is according to local farmers and an Israeli rights non-government organisation called Gisha. And Palestinians who reported the incident said the planes had dusted near the Gaza border fence, and the Gaza Ministry of Agriculture is investigating the exact extent of the damage from the herbicide sprayed over those 2 days. Around, 840 acres of crops, doesn't seem like much, damaged during the previous round of spraying in January. It doesn't sound like much, but it's part of an ongoing operation. They do it frequently. And you remember the white phosphorus rained on that same population just a few short years ago. Next example. In 2006, the US spent more on the war in Iraq than the whole world spent on investment in renewable energy. On the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War, an advance edition of a new report from Oil Change International, which they called A Climate of War, quantifies both the greenhouse gas emissions of the Iraq War and the opportunity costs involved in fighting war rather than climate change. Yes, opportunity costs. So, for instance, if the war were ranked as a country in terms of annual emissions, it would emit more CO2 each year than 139 of the world's nations do, more than 60% of all countries on the planet. The emissions associated with the war in Iraq are largely unreported. Military emissions abroad are not counted in the national greenhouse gas inventories that all industrialised nations, including the US, report under United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Next. Information from 2007 refers to the connection between the Iraq War and activity in the Gulf in general, with US acquisition of oil and the White House's continuing dependence on oil and connections to the oil industry. But it also reveals that when broken down, when taken into account the total number of soldiers, sailors, all armed forces in the war, figures show that each single individual there to be using 16 gallons of oil daily, amounting to a staggering 3 million gallons daily. The same consumed daily by the whole population of Bangladesh, almost 150 million people. And these figures don't take any account of the carbon dioxide released by pipeline and refinery explosions, of which there are many, the aircraft used to ferry US troops in and out of Iraq, and other war-related activities. Next one. By the late 1980s, public data revealed that the Pentagon was generating a ton of toxic waste a minute. And as I mentioned earlier, more toxic waste than the 5 or 6 or 8 chemical companies combined, making it the largest polluter in the United States. But this figure didn't include the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons plants or the Pentagon's civilian contractors. The Army Corps of Engineers labelled a 100-acre basin at Rocky Mountain Arsenal near Denver, Colorado, that stored waste from the production of nerve gas and pesticides from World War II right through the Vietnam era. They called it the Earth's most toxic square mile. This is only one of their many. Military testing requires national and international sacrifice zones, they call them. Among them, Jefferson Proving Grounds in Madison, Indiana, which are 100 square miles of the most contaminated, contiguous land in the United States, cordoned off and abandoned because the land was too dangerous to attempt to clear up. Currently, nearly 900 of the Environmental Protection Agency's approximately 1,300 what they call Superfund sites, they are the collective of waste sites classified as those most hazardous to human or ecological health. They're abandoned military bases or facilities. 900 of the 1,300 they have are military. They're either military bases, abandoned military bases, or military industrial manufacturing and testing sites that produce weapons, vehicles, and other military-related products and services. The sites include chemical warfare and research facilities, plane, ship and tank manufacture and repair facilities, training and manoeuvre bases, and abandoned disposal pits. Common contaminants include metal cleaning solvents, pesticides, machine oils, metals, metalworking fluids, and chemical ingredients used in explosives. They're dumped into pits, leaking from corroding containers, buried in unlined landfills, left on test ranges, and military toxics have leached into groundwater and polluted drinking water on a large scale. This example is from 2015. The US Air Force is the single largest consumer of jet fuel in the world. Fathom, if you can, the astronomical fuel usage of US Air Force fighter planes. The F-4 Phantom fighter burns more than 1,600 gallons of jet fuel per hour and peaks at 14,400 gallons an hour at supersonic speeds. But the B-52 Stratocruiser, with 8 jet engines, guzzles 500 gallons a minute, which is just about as much fuel as the average driver in many places uses in a year. A quarter of the world's jet fuel, a quarter of the whole world's jet fuel, feeds the United States Air Force fleet. An astounding 2.6 billion gallons. And individual people attempt to reduce their own carbon footprint in the hope of making a difference. The issue of military fuel and its massive yet concealed role in global climate change has recently been revealed thanks to a handful of researchers. For instance, Lisker and Perrin, who contend that in addition to tailpipe emissions, immense hidden greenhouse gas pollution stems from the use of petrol. This impact on climate change should be calculated into the full life cycle analysis of petrol. When the Environmental Protection Agency compares petrol and biofuels for their respective atmospheric pollution, the greenhouse gas emissions calculated for petrol should include the military activities related also to securing foreign crude oil from which petrol is derived. But they don't, again, thanks to the Kyoto Accords military exemption. Oil security comprises both military protection against sabotage to pipelines and tankers, and also US-led wars in oil-rich regions to assure long-term access. It just shows how much subsidiary pollution, environment damage there is done by not just the war-making, but all the before, the what goes with it to support it, afterwards, ongoing. Some finding from Oil Change International regarding policy decisions over the years on fuel choices, attitude to global warming and opportunities for making profit and military backing for any ventures, they really do make salient reading. Here are a few examples from that. The projected full costs of the Iraq war, estimated at $3 trillion, would cover all of the global investments in renewable power generation needed between now and 2030 to reverse global warming trends. Rebuilding Iraqi schools, homes, businesses, bridges, roads and hospitals pulverised by the war, plus new security walls and barriers, will require millions of tonnes of cement, one of the largest industrial sources of greenhouse gas emissions. I think yesterday Greg told us that was three of the four most important things, didn't he? And this also backs that up, you see. The amount of cement to make concrete that is continually used after war, creating more and more pollution. By 2008, the Bush administration had spent 97 times more on military than on climate change alleviation. As a candidate, Obama pledged to spend $150 billion over 10 years on green energy technology and infrastructure. $150 billion over 10 years. Less than they were spending in 1 year on the Iraq War. Back a few years, 1952, 65 years ago, anyone remember the Paley Commission? They put in a report which proposed that the US build the economy on solar energy sources. The report also offered a strong negative assessment of nuclear energy and called for aggressive research in the whole field of solar energy, as well as research and development on wind and biomass. In 1953, the new president, Eisenhower, ignored the report's recommendations and inaugurated Atoms for Peace, which touted nuclear power as the world's new energy miracle. Apart from nuclear, this decision put oil, gas and coal central to the US economy. Oil, remember, oil, gas. Now, by the late 1970s, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the Iranian Revolution threatened US access to oil in the Middle East, leading to President Carter's 1980 State of the Union Doctrine. The Carter Doctrine holds that Any threat to US access to Middle East oil would be resisted by any means necessary, including military force. Carter put teeth into his doctrine by creating the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force, whose purpose was to combat operations in the Persian Gulf area when necessary. Reagan ramped up the militarisation of oil with the formation of a US CENTCOM, Central Command, whose raison d'etre was to ensure access to oil, diminish Soviet Union influence in the region, and control political regimes in the region for national security interests. With growing reliance on oil from Africa and the Caspian Sea, the US has since augmented its military capabilities in those regions too. Right, I consider here that some mention of depleted uranium is absolute must for inclusion. I won't go into details of what it is. I'm sure everybody knows basically what it's generally referred to, DU, is a byproduct, a waste product. It's an externality of the nuclear industry. It's a nuisance. It was a nuisance for a long time. They didn't know what to do with it. And it needs such careful storage because of its horrendous dangers. I mean, any exposure to it constitutes a huge cancer risk, and unborn or even as yet not conceived babies have a high risk of horrible genetic outcomes. Eventually, they saw this waste product, this externality, as an opportunity, a positive even, a free source of material for making so highly effective bullets, bombs and rockets. We could pierce armoured vehicles, tanks and the like. The United States has stockpiled an estimated 450,000 tonnes of depleted uranium. And now, using it in war has been a convenient method of waste disposal in other countries' backyards. Depleted uranium used by US and British invading forces during the 1991 Gulf War and in the 2003 war in Iraq, among other places, is one of a number of suspected sources of the soaring increase in childhood leukemia since 1993 in Basra, and also of the birth defects and gross neonatal abnormalities, infant death and sex ratio anomalies in Fallujah. An estimated 320 tonnes of depleted uranium used in weapons during the 1991 Gulf War. About 12 tonnes were used in the Balkans in the late 90s. Available information suggests the US and British forces released about between 90 and 110, 180 tonnes of DU in intense airstrikes at the onset of the 2003 Iraq War, while some estimate that more than 1,000 tonnes may have been used throughout that war. Civilian populations in these depleted uranium-contaminated sites will be exposed to ongoing hotspots of DU soil contamination and groundwater contamination, since systematic surveillance of soil and underground water has not been the norm in areas of conflict where these weapons have been employed. So depleted uranium exposure during and after war adds long-term radiological and chemical exposure risks to the already existing risks of death, injury, and incredible environmental damage from war. Now, what I've commented on so far has actually happened, or is actually happening currently, and it's well documented, but I really don't think we can discuss the military and its detrimental effects on the environment without considering the potential threat of nuclear war. And there's a guy, I read something of his recently, Stephen Starr. He's a senior scientist at Physicians for Social Responsibility and an associate with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. And he was recently interviewed at length on this matter. And I'm going to read to you exactly what he said. The US and Russia each have about 1,000 strategic nuclear weapons of at least 100 kilotons, all ready to launch within 2 to 15 minutes. And these are only missiles that are on a hair trigger alert. If the US and Russia get into a direct military conflict, eventually one side or the other will start to lose. They either then admit defeat or they escalate, and the possibility of using nuclear weapons becomes higher. Once nukes start going off, escalation to full-scale nuclear war could happen very quickly. Nuclear winter, one of the long-term environmental consequences of nuclear war, would probably cause most people on the planet to die of starvation within a couple of years of a large US-Russian nuclear war. The global stratospheric smoke layer produced by nuclear firestorms would block most sunlight from reaching the surface of the Earth, producing ice age weather conditions that would last for at least 10 years. And another rarely discussed consequence of nuclear war is high altitude electromagnetic pulse, EMP. A large nuclear weapon detonated at high altitude, between 100 and 200 miles, will produce an enormous pulse of electrical energy, which will destroy electronic circuits in an area of tens of thousands of square miles below the blast. A single detonation over the US East Coast would destroy the grid and cause every nuclear power plant affected by electromagnetic pulse to melt down. Imagine 60 Fukushimas happening at the same time in the US. End of quote. But back to the present. Military exercises. How do you learn to get better at war? You practice. You take all the stuff, and especially all the new stuff you can get your hands on, and you go somewhere quiet and out of the way and have a really good time because you know there's going to be no retaliation. E.g., this June, same as in June 2015, the US Navy's plans threatened an area of the Gulf of Alaska that couldn't be more biologically sensitive or rich in wildlife. It's called Northern Edge 17, 2017. Their training area includes, listen to this, their training area includes a State of Alaska Marine Protected Area, a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Protected Area, and both the Gulf of Alaska Seamount Protected Area and Slope Habitat Conservation Area. Nevertheless, the Navy requested permits to use live ordnance along with active and passive sonar in realistic war training exercises that could release as much as 352,000 pounds of expended materials into those waters, according to the Navy's own environmental impacts statement. Missiles, bombs and torpedoes were going to be used. The Navy's environmental impact statement does estimate that during the years in which these war games are to be conducted, there will be more than 182,000 takes, that is, direct deaths of marine mammals or disruptions of their essential behaviours like breeding, nursing or surfacing. On fish deaths, it offers no estimates at all. No fewer than a dozen native tribes rely on the area for subsistence living, not to speak of their cultural and spiritual identities. Immediately following Northern Edge 15, 2015, Alaska witnessed the single largest whale mortality ever to occur in its waters. 18 carcasses of endangered whales were found floating near Kodiak Island within the area with which the Navy had conducted its exercises. Statewide, in the year that followed, Alaska had its worst pink salmon fishing season in decades. A federal disaster declaration was even issued to give salmon fishermen some relief, deferring repayment of loans. That year also saw the biggest die-off of a small seabird, the murres, ever recorded in the state. Human-caused climate disruption impacts had long been noted across the North Pacific, whose climate change-affected waters were already warming to record temperatures that year. While this obviously played a role in such events, what impact the naval exercises had across the Gulf of Alaska remained largely unknown, in part because the Navy refused in 2015, as again this year, to allow independent observers on its ships or to conduct follow-up studies on how their war games had impacted the environment and marine life. I mean, just as an aside, that's one country. What about all the other military exercises taking place, you know, across the globe, whether it's the US, whether it's NATO, AFRICOM, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and on and on and on? all over the world. And while we're in Alaska there, it's a short hop from Alaska to the North Pole, where a new 5-year strategic plan by the US Navy outlines the militarization of the Arctic to defend national security, potential undersea riches, and other maritime interests, anticipating the frozen Arctic Ocean to be open waters by 2030. More pollution of one kind or another lies in wait, and we heard something about that yesterday evening as well. Okay, moving on. According to author Cliff Connor, he wrote The People's History of Science. American science's primary mission is to find new and more efficient ways to kill people. From thermonuclear bombs to robot drones, cluster munitions to anti-personnel weaponry of many kinds. He sees that science and technology, rather than being the creative engines of human progress, have instead been reoriented towards destructive and anti-human ends. It has also made beneficial advances, but many of those have been accidental byproducts of military research. The proof he offers is in the US budget, where more than half of the research and development funding, amounting to trillions of dollars over the past decades, has been for military purposes. He further suggests that we imagine, by contrast, what could be accomplished if all of that money and all of that scientific talent were instead directed toward finding solutions to the crucial problems facing the human race today, such as poverty, hunger, disease, and, particularly relevant to us here this weekend, environmental devastation. As for any discussion whether science and technology can be reoriented from destructive to creative purposes by a transformation of the economic system, well, replacing the current science-for-profit system by a science-for-human-needs system is not an impossible utopian dream. To make it a reality, however, the author affirms that that requires a fundamental restructuring of our society. I wonder if that sounds familiar to anyone here. And as for profitable enterprises relating to the military, I read something re Labour Day, May the 1st this year, and I quote, "The US is a failing empire. The domestic economy has fallen to a level equivalent to a developing nation for most of us, while the stock markets, especially for weapons makers, are at record levels." As we're in the UK here, and I suspect the vast majority of people live here in the UK, I thought I did consider getting some stuff to give you about the UK figures, but really, the time would be involved, it would just get more boring numbers and they'd be much smaller than you've been hearing, although you might feel more personally responsible for them or know that that's why you hate what goes on here. But anyway, I didn't, but I made a list of stuff that's quite useful if you want it. So let's have a look at the revolving door. It's the vicious spiral, I like to call it. The various elements contribute to this vicious spiral: hegemony, acquisition of resources for profit, and the revolving door. Think of the economic hitman. I think I mentioned him last time I was here. It's explained so well by John Perkins. Big corporations and governments apply economic pressure on weaker nations using developmental loans and coercive techniques, and if they refuse to be compliant, they get taken over by military or mercenaries in order to install a most suitable leader or dictator who will be allowed to stay in post until he becomes defiant, like Panama Torrijos and Noriega. More recently, it's exactly really what happened in Iraq and Libya. Why did Saddam Hussein have to go? Why didn't Muammar Gaddafi have to go? And now, currently, we've got in the crosshairs, we've got Bashar al-Assad in Syria, got to go. He's in the crosshairs now. You know, military needs hardware. And military hardware has to be manufactured for profit. There's no profit in stockpiling. It has to be sold, used, and reordered for ongoing use. Military also needs oil. Lots of oil. I said that you've heard about that before. It needs to be extracted from the ground and refined. Regular sales and deliveries of both of these are vital, and this is where the revolving door works so well. Links between democratically elected MPs, lawmakers, they call them in the US, retired senior military officers, representatives of both military hardware manufacturing and oil industries, the lobbying industry. Yes, there are rules and regulations supposedly protecting the public interest against individuals using their influence because of their position or former position for personal profit, but really, does that work? You will all know examples of that here where, no, it doesn't work. People are profiting nicely from it. You know, the middle people as well as the people at the top who are producing. So whether it's former top military brass happy to promote on TV in order to be on some manufacturer's payroll, or elected politicians post-service taking up advisory roles, or even whilst in office, you think back to Dick Cheney and Halliburton, Condoleezza Rice and ExxonMobil, it's an industry in itself. And you can find an endless list of articles on this topic, endless. You just have to type in something like links between retired military personnel and manufacturers of war material, or something like military politicians, media and the revolving door, anything that will do. You get pages, oceans of it. Lobbying and the revolving door is the gift, it never stops giving. Now, here's one small bit on the current debacle in Syria from a writer called Peter Koenig. This is what he says. In Syria, the stakes are high. In addition to the insane profits of the war and weapons industry, there is little talked about the Qatar-Turkey-Syria pipeline that was to bring oil and gas from the Gulf to Europe to demolish the Russian gas market in Europe and to make trillions for US petrol giants, a pipeline Mr. Assad rejected in 2009. Instead, he approved and promoted the Iran pipeline through Syria to Europe. Iranian hydrocarbons would complement rather than compete with gas and oil from Russia to Europe. And that's when Obama decided that Bashar al-Assad had to go. It also fitted the bigger picture. A balkanised Middle East with steady conflicts fueling the war industry, but eventually leading to a greater Israel stretching from the Euphrates to the Nile, absorbing parts of Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon and Egypt. So not just the usual despoilation of ground and water and the poisoning of the air connected with oil extraction, but add to that control of the resources and ongoing conflict. That gift, again, that never stops giving for the few. Nearly there. Yeah, often when we think about or discuss the probable future scenario for this planet as the habitat for all its various life forms, it does seem like we're facing insurmountable odds. However, whatever I said last night, I do tend to agree with John Bellamy Foster's view, who he wrote that what we have to do isn't so difficult on the face of it if we just look at the direct ecological measures we need to take. What makes it seem like an insurmountable problem is the monstrosity of global capitalist society. And we certainly know what that means and exactly what that challenge is and what's to do. Got a very simple analogy here. I just thought I'd just take a couple of minutes. I remember some old TV programs yonks ago, and we don't see British TV now, so I've no idea what you have on. They focused on showing people how to get a grip on their somewhat chaotic lives. First, the experts would come in to give your house, your living space, a thorough clean out, and then start from the beginning again. Throw out the absolute rubbish, the useless stuff you've clung on to for so long. Choose carefully the essential and useful items and offer publicly the remains to society to reuse, recycle or discard. In a nutshell, it was about life change. Now, why not use this sort of thing as a starting point for system change when we get there, when we are there? Capitalism, whilst not actively chosen by workers, we were all just born into it, is the system dependent on us to keep it functioning on a daily basis, although not as we would choose to be running it. And although, yes, it does have many useful facets, it includes so much that is detrimental for us. So throughout the useful institutions and any elements not required in a socialist society, consider how certain sections can be adapted to suit the new system, utilised and as decided beneficial, and build together on collective strengths. That's what it's all about, I think. It isn't that utopia is unachievable, but rather it is prevented deliberately from coming about by the power of the powerful minority within established societies. And as far as the huge problems we have with the global environment and climate change, it isn't that we haven't known about them until recently. Both the climate and nuclear threats were well known by the 60s. People like Barry Commoner, Murray Bookchin, and I'll mention Rachel Carson again. They were all telling us about the dangers of the externalities and the indisputable links between the fouling of the environment and the capitalist system. But what changed? How do we get around the politics of capitalism, which is so obviously the cause of global warming and climate change? The struggle for power, world hegemony, goes on apace. US against a, you name it, Russian-Asian partnership, any other 1984-type combination you dare to foresee. But wars, military aggression, armed incursions, interventions for one reason or another are definitely not the decision of an informed populace. They are the decisions of the masters of capitalism. Ignorance is bred and perpetuated by the media arm of these masters, the owners of corporate worldwide media. Fear of the other is fed to us daily. Indifference, ignorance, inattention to world politics is fatal. For those who do pay attention, many hold on to a hope that some progressive, forward-looking institution or protest movement will somehow, someday, fix everything. But without realising or taking into account the critical time frame posed by the Earth's physical laws. History is what occurred earlier, whether a century, a decade, or last year. It should tell us why we are where we are. It should tell us why we are where we are now, as we focus this weekend specifically on the environment. And it does, if we pay attention. History tells us there is no solution in capitalism. And history tells us there's no interest in a solution in capitalism. If we have to have any chance of a world for sustaining us as a species into the future, there is only one answer. And we understand what that is. Capitalism must go.